Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Grunts of Wrath, a memoir by Ronnie Bruce, narrated by Jamie Rennell. Well, here I am. Anonymous, all right. With guys nobody really cares about. They come from the end of the line, most of them. Small towns you never heard of. Pulaski, Tennessee, Brandon, Mississippi. Pork Bend, Utah. Wampum, Pennsylvania. 2 years high school's about it. Maybe, if they're lucky, a job waiting for them back in a factory. But most of them got nothing. They're poor. They're the unwanted. Yet they're fighting for our society and our freedom. It's weird, isn't it? At the bottom of the barrel, and they know it. Maybe that's why they call themselves grunts. 'Cause a grunt can take it, can take anything. The best I've ever seen, Grandma. The heart and soul. Chris Taylor, Charlie Sheen, Platoon. Prologue. It was 2014, and I was wasting away inside my deepest, darkest personal hell. There was no way out. I was ready to pull the plug. My chance arrived while driving on a Griffin, Georgia country road. A vehicle sped up from behind me and proceeded to ride my bumper. When I hit the gas, the vehicle matched me. If I slowed, it slowed. To shake the vehicle, I turned on a desolate two-lane street. But the car turned and continued to follow. Its front bumper kissed my rear. In a fit of rage, I pulled to the side of the road. "Please move along," I thought. Yet, to my astonishment, the vehicle coasted to the side and parked to my rear. The joke was over. I exited my vehicle and stalked to the driver's side of the tailgating car. It was a lowered rice burner, an old Honda Civic with a spoiler. Two dudes sat inside. They appeared to be teenage white boys who thought they were gangsters. "Man, please." The driver wore a flat-bill hat with aviators perched atop his nose and cheap-looking gold swag around his neck. The passenger was a shaggy-haired kid with a nervous look. The follower, I mentally named him. Without breaking stride, I rounded the driver's side door and stomped my right heel into it, placing a dent. Old Flatbill reached into his glove box, pulled a pistol, and pointed it at my chest. The gun fidgeted inside his hands. "Go on, shoot me," I shouted. "Come on, man, let's get the hell out of here," the follower said. "You don't have the balls, son," I egged him on. Flatbill hit reverse, and the rice burner sped off. "Little bitch," I shouted as it sped away. Walking back to my car, I wept in silence. I wept because I knew I wanted that kid to shoot. Had Flatbill found his balls and pulled the trigger, I'd be given a pass. Suicide by punk. I'd survive the Taliban, Mujahideen, Al-Qaeda, Chechen mercenaries, and other foreign fighters. But I was ready to meet my demise at the hands of two rednecks on the side of a rural Georgia highway. A local paper would have vilified these hoodlums for murdering a hero war veteran. I'd be the victim. My wish to end the torment would be granted. Days later, I arrived at a crossroad, still eager to die. I laid my deathbed, lounging on my couch with a highball in one hand and a Springfield semi-automatic 40-caliber handgun resting on my lap. The highball was strong, 70% bourbon and 30% coke. I had one problem, though. I didn't have the balls to do it. As I wallowed in my funk, I wished I had the guts that my buddies Clover, Paris, and Stansberry possessed. Perhaps my subconscious mind would help complete the task. Yes, my subconscious mind. It had done several things over the years that I wasn't proud of, while my rational mind was blackout drunk. During the 2013 Christmas season, it had led me on a 30-mile drive through St. Louis. I found myself on a sidewalk, awakened by the bright bulb of a flashlight, with both mirrors smashed off my vehicle. My subconscious mind had led to being tossed from a bar or two and some check-ins inside a drunk tank. I was asking a lot from it, though. My subconscious mind had led me down silly and fruitless endeavors, no harm, no foul type stuff. Yet at that moment, I begged it to finish me. I guzzled the highballs one after the other with the pistol sitting to my side. My mind combed through everything that had led me here. I had lived life as a rational thinker, who always used logic rather than emotion to guide my decisions. I refused to fall in love in Okinawa, San Diego, and Anchorage because I knew I wouldn't be living in those places forever. I never fathered children with my ex-wife during our short marriage because I didn't feel our I's were dotted and T's were crossed. I lived by methodical thinking. But at the moment, logic and rationale were nowhere to be found. I woke the next morning in a haze. My lap was drenched because the glass in my hand had tilted forward and emptied. The couch reeked of whiskey. My head was smoking, but thoughts slowly returned. I'm alive. Where's my gun? Despite my dizziness, I stood and searched for the handgun destined to kill me. Upon entering my bedroom, I discovered the case for my Springfield 40 closed and fastened, sitting atop my bed. I opened the case and studied the pistol. The magazine was removed, and the bullets weren't inside. I grabbed the weapon and charged it. No round was ejected since the chamber was emptied. The loaded bullet with Ronnie B.'s name was packed inside its container, invisible amongst the others. I had no recollection of clearing the weapon and placing it inside its case. My subconscious mind had sent a clear message. Time to live again. Without knowing my end goal, I organized my thoughts and wrote words on paper. I jotted notes and typed ideas. On and off for years, I dabbled with this side project. Producing a manuscript wasn't my initial goal. Writing about my experiences was comforting. It healed. It forced me to tap into the discipline that once kept me motivated and led to moderate success during my earlier years. It gave me purpose. It was necessary to understand why a guy like me, a former social butterfly, happy-go-lucky, accomplished man who despised sitting at home and thought depression was weak, was mired in a deep funk that culminated with me breathing down the barrel of my own gun. During my 20s, I kicked ass. I received an honorable discharge from the Marines, utilized the GI Bill, and earned a bachelor's degree. My name was often on the dean's list at Kennesaw State. I taught world history and current issues in high school for a couple years, and was an assistant coach for football and wrestling. Marriage was one of the few mistakes I made, but it was rectified with a call to 1-800-DIVORCE. There's no hate for the ex. We didn't gel, so we split in an amicable way. Despite all this success, the allure of war was too much. In the summer of 2008, weeks before my 32nd birthday, I knocked on Uncle Sam's door and said, "Let me back in." Army infantry this time. It had been 10 years since I last wore the uniform. Back then, it was a peacetime military. The only combat action ribbon I saw was worn by a battalion sergeant major, a crusty old bastard still serving over 20 years after Vietnam. An STD from an Asian whorehouse was my biggest threat in those days. Yet, this second dance with Uncle Sam would be a grind. As I wrote, I had to explore beyond myself. I had to examine my platoon, company, battalion, and brigade. I had to understand the men. It's been 12 years since the Freedom Bird flew my unit home from the 12-month deployment to Afghanistan. During these years, members of my platoon have caught felonies, sat behind bars, slept under bridges, boozed, drugged, and fought. Some men, too young, are buried underground. Don't get me wrong, there are success stories. There were degrees and advanced degrees earned, high salaries obtained, small businesses started, and high-level government positions filled. Some men remained in the army and were promoted to high ranks or served in elite units. Some redeployed. But the bad seems to outweigh the good. Allow me to spit some stats. My platoon consisted of 30 men, and the company housed 100, give or take. A dozen years following the deployment, my hand is full when I count a finger for each suicide by people I knew. I don't have enough fingers and toes to count the number of people who succumbed to depression, alcoholism, drug abuse, homelessness, or crime. It stings each time I receive a text or call asking, "Did you hear about so-and-so?" It's devastating to hear, "So-and-so is dead." I answered a call from an old platoon buddy one Saturday night and was told, "Dude, had you not answered, I was going to blow my brains out." I talked him down. One young man was murdered in Alaska under shady circumstances. A text from an old platoon mate last week read, "Don't loan you-know-who dollars if he contacts you, 'cause he's just going to buy dope. He's living in his car and has several warrants out for his arrest. His own dad told me he's stolen from him and other members of FAM." A sergeant, our company medic, committed an armed robbery following his discharge. While out on bail, he robbed a bank, which resulted in a 25-year prison sentence. I was shocked. Doc was a quality leader and medic, well-regarded. His life-saving exploits from Operation Iraqi Freedom were legendary. 2 deployments, 2 theaters, 27 months of combat, 25 years in prison. What went wrong? Doc's prosecutor said, "This defendant received training to protect and serve our country. He betrayed that public trust and used that training against the citizens he took an oath to defend." Doc isn't the only Charlie Company guy from the 2009-2010 deployment to spend at least a year in prison. So, what about me? Before my reenlistment, I experienced adult failures for the first time. That brought me to Uncle Sam again, my failures and my curiosity about combat. While most of my peers were knee-deep into careers and playing house in a suburban bubble, old Ronnie B. said to hell with that. It wasn't appealing. I needed to feel the fire again. Despite earning a degree and being eligible to serve as an officer, I chose to reenlist as an enlisted grunt. Infantry enlisted men are the trailer park in town compared to the Chateau Elan winery and resort of the officer corps. Events are told from a grunt's eye view. No reporters documented our moves. There were no epic battles and no decorated soldiers to fawn over. However, there are several Purple Hearts, since half my platoon was wounded in battle. If we'd counted concussions as medals, then Purple Hearts would blanket the platoon. There was nothing elite about us either. None of us were special operators or high-speed war machines. We were grunts on the front lines. I consulted with my former acting platoon sergeant, squad leader, team leader, and a few guys from the platoon to ensure authenticity. Events derived from my notes, emails, records, awards, and memory. I added accounts from other soldiers, since I'm human and not omnipresent. Yes, I received the blessings of the men. They encouraged me to see this through to the end, since the story informs the world community of what went down in the fight against insurgents, guerrillas, jihadists, and hardened Taliban armies, along with the price paid. If any mistakes were made, I apologize. The chaos and confusion of war can lead to fuzzy details in some cases. The characters are real. I used nicknames and first names to protect their identities, or I altered first or last names when referring to them. Politics are a buzzkill, but discussing politics can't be avoided when telling stories of combat. Politicians and commanders create foreign policy and give orders, while soldiers follow orders on behalf of the U.S. government. Any opinions are my own, and don't necessarily reflect those of others in the platoon. Struggle is a curse most people wouldn't wish for, but it's been a blessing to me. Enduring chaos and accomplishing difficult tasks have value. Failures either break you or lead you to learn and improve. Too many good people aren't dealing with their struggles and failures well. They're lost and hopeless. So, I offer my story, along with the stories of other warriors, to examine struggle and failure. To ask why we struggle. Perhaps answering and coping mechanisms will be derived and redemption achieved. I speak candidly about my issues to lift others who may feel like a square peg failing to fit into society's round hole. I'm a square peg. The men of my former platoon are square pegs. We are the grunts of wrath. Chapter 1. Friends, Romans, ATLians. Cheers, the bartender poured another drink. I sipped a highball as fresh ink dried on my divorce papers. It wasn't a celebratory night. I wanted to decompress and ponder my next moves. It was summer 2006 and a time of change. In addition to my divorce, I'd resigned from my teaching and coaching positions. I had cashed out what had been built inside my retirement fund. Teaching is a noble profession, but I didn't envision enjoying it for 30 years. Time to move forward. I'd soon be moving to another town and reinventing myself as a child-free divorcee. The retirement fund cheddar would keep me afloat while my transformation took place. Everything will be fine, I told myself. Before I relaxed too much, my phone rang. Hello? Hey, man, what's up? The voice asked. Sitting at the bar, I said. Who's this? This old wildfire, bitch. Old wildfire. Yes, we have a history. He was a solid friend, but we hadn't seen one another in 7 years. Following my discharge from the Marines, Wildfire and I tore up the nightlife. We ran hard. My last experience with Wildfire had ended with him being dragged off by police while screaming, "Don't you know who the fuck I am?" Not long after the incident, I moved to attend college. During that time, Wildfire's professional life skyrocketed, and he'd also married and divorced. Wildfire had always been self-employed. During his earlier days, he ran a pressure cleaning business servicing newly constructed apartments in and around Atlanta, Georgia. We referred to his business as a redneck business, the type where the tools of the trade can be pulled on a trailer behind a pickup truck. It was blue-collar. Mexican laborers served as employees, and Wildfire even learned to speak Spanish, somewhat fluently. It wasn't abnormal to see Wildfire's pickup and trailer parked by the bar while he sat inside, donning his cowboy hat, pearl button shirt, and cowboy boots. Fast forward to 2006. Wildfire, through hard work and family fortune, had upgraded to the part owner of a successful plastic surgery practice in Atlanta. He partnered with a doctor who possessed impeccable credentials, Emory University graduate, dentist and oral surgeon who retrained to become a plastic surgeon. Wildfire ran the business and performed laser procedures for which he was certified while the doc did his thing as a surgeon. Wildfire's pickups became BMWs. Pearl-button shirts were replaced by button-downs and tailored sport coats. Starched Wranglers became designer jeans and cowboy boots morphed into fine Italian leather shoes. The cowboy hat was lost and replaced with a slick hairdo and a few plugs. A metrosexual was created. "Where you at?" Wildfire asked. "At a bar in McDonough? I'll be down to get you." It was on. An hour later, an upscale black Lincoln pulled into the lot. The back door opened, and I hopped in. Wildfire sat to my left with a Coors Light in hand, grinning ear to ear. An older black man drove. He'd already driven over 40 miles from one side of Atlanta to the other to snatch me. "What's going on, old Ronnie B?" "Oh, you know, same old shit." "Have a beer," Wildfire said as he passed a Coors Light. "We ain't got to worry about shit. We've got a driver, I know people, and I've got Mr. Goodtimes in my pocket." Wildfire smirked, reached into his pocket, and retrieved a little baggie of blow. I smiled and flashed the horns with my left hand. It had been years since I partied like that. We toasted and proceeded to catch up. "I'm proud of you, man." Wildfire grabbed my neck and yanked us together cheek to cheek. "For going to college and kicking ass?" "Dude, I'm proud of you," I replied. "Yeah, but I'm pissed I didn't finish my..." "Fuck that," I interrupted. "You're fucking Wildfire, baby, a businessman, an entrepreneur. Woo!" We snorted a bump and proceeded to Buckhead, a swanky district in Atlanta with a popular bar strip. The crowds were large and rowdy. Wildfire and I snorted bumps, drank glasses of fine bourbon, and dazzled the young ladies with our charm. Wildfire was edgy and a pain in the ass sometimes. He'd lunge towards an unsuspecting stranger and blow his burp into their face. They'd startle, and he'd look in the other direction as if nothing happened. Sometimes he'd shout, "There she is," and point straight at a beautiful lady passing by. When she stopped to acknowledge him, he'd adjust his finger to suggest he was pointing elsewhere, and she was mistaken. Sometimes it sparked a conversation for a hookup. Other times it drew a fuck off. I was by his side to say, "Come on, Wildfire," and quell the drama. The best-case scenario for less confrontation was when Wildfire crossed paths with a Hispanic male. He loved practicing his Spanish. It kept him occupied long enough for the bar worker to finish taking out trash or stocking the bar. I laughed, hearing the drunken mix of cocaine-induced southern drawl in Espanol. Wildfire called his driver to scoop us up and take us somewhere else. As we waited outside, he spotted a black Ford across the street. Giddy from blow, we sprinted toward the vehicle and jumped inside. "Oh, shit," Wildfire said. "What the fuck?" the African-American driver yelled. We exited quickly because we'd unwittingly stormed an unmarked police car. Before we could flee, the officer said, "Hold on a second." Wildfire leaped into action. "I'm sorry, sir, I thought you were my driver." Before the officer pried further, I chimed in. "Sir, do you think we'd jump into a police car on purpose?" The officer couldn't choke down his laughter. "I've been doing this for 20 years and never had this happen." Everyone laughed. The cop left, and Wildfire patted his leg pocket and said, "Good thing he's cool." I had moved back to an old familiar place after my divorce. Kennesaw, Georgia, located 20 miles northwest of Atlanta, is where I attended college. It was an improvement from the depressed south side of town where I was raised. Kennesaw residents are a mix of yuppies, college students, and old-school rednecks who keep Southern heritage alive. I hung with Wildfire more often since he lived in Smyrna, a few miles south of Kennesaw. He had the ultimate bachelor's pad, 2 stories of condo space inside an upscale district with bars, restaurants, and high-dollar shopping fronts. Beautiful women suffused the area. Located steps from his door was a popular bar. Some weekends, the city blocked off the district and hosted parties with rows of beer tents, live music, and beautiful ladies, all under Wildfire's nose. Wildfire spent a lot of time with Emmy, a slick-talking carpetbagger from upstate New York. When dressed in a designer button-down, Emmy told the affluent ladies he was a commodities broker to sell himself. He was, but his occupation got dirty and dealt with rough customers. We all told bullshit that showed our lives in the most positive light, but Emmy was the master. His industry was booming due to Atlanta's explosive growth. Profits were high. Our friend circle was small, but acquaintances were limitless. We spent many nights inside the bar located steps from the condo. Each time, a dozen strangers accompanied us back to Wildfire's for the after-party. Booze, blow, music, and other activities took place until sunrise. Wildfire's home appeared to be the site of an endless party. There were holes in kitchen walls where Wildfire tossed knives like darts. Empty beer bottles littered the corner pool table, and cocaine dust sprinkled countertops. An industrial-sized trash can on wheels rested by a wall. Dresser drawers inside the master bedroom were opened, and clothes were tossed everywhere. On a nightstand, a half-full pitcher of beer sat with several cigarette butts inside. Dead plants and rotted trees served as decor. The most amusing flaw was the holes inside the pool table, caused when a drunken Wildfire accidentally discharged his pistol. He lived a honky-tonk lifestyle. 3 others were close associates to Wildfire, Kenny, Lauren, and Wayne. Kenny was a laid-back black dude who was quiet and cool, by all accounts. He worked in a restaurant inside the development and supplied Wildfire with blow and an occasional ride from a club. Lauren, 22, and a Kennesaw State student, was a typical college girl who enjoyed the nightlife. Despite possessing maturity beyond her years, she was a sweetheart. We bonded over Kennesaw State, since that was my alma mater. Old Wayne was a dude I'd known forever. We shared a birthday and attended the same high school. He'd fallen on hard times, though. Wildfire moved Wayne in since he'd been evicted from his apartment, a property owned by Wildfire's uncle. Wayne was large, standing 6'4", and weighing close to 300 pounds. He was balding on top, but rather than shaving his head, he grew his side hair into a skullet. Why shave it when you can rock it? He wore a trucker-style mesh cap over his skullet, a handlebar mustache, and a Winston Red was nestled between his lips on the reg. We're ATLians. Atlanta rap duo Outkast coined the term in their 1996 album, and locals ran with it. I was born in Georgia Baptist Hospital downtown on the Boulevard and raised on the South Side. The area is located below Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport and infamously known as the Clayco. Classy ATLians hang in Atlanta's finest places. The crew piled inside Wildfire's Series 6 BMW convertible and headed downtown. Wildfire is a well-connected ATLian, too. He knew the person working the door of every club. If a joint wasn't popping, we left. Never paying a dime to enter, Wildfire would strut to the front and say, "I'm Wildfire, baby," and we'd follow him inside. Some clubs had a $100 cover, but we were still welcomed free of charge. If there was a line, we'd walk around it like VIPs. With Wildfire, Emmy and I acted like our favorite 1980s professional wrestling, a.k.a. wrestling, heroes. Ric Flair was our number one. Before leaving, we would watch YouTube videos of Ric Flair's promos to get fired up. In fact, Wildfire's nickname derived from old-school ATLian wrestling legend Tommy Wildfire Rich. Rich was a local superstar, known for living fast and hard. They say hanging with Rich during his prime in Atlanta was like hanging with Elvis. Ladies loved him. He had a 4-day reign as the NWA World Champion, but never reached his full potential. His prime was short-lived, and he spent many years performing inside high school gymnasiums on the unflattering indie circuit. His life mirrors Mickey Rourke's character in The Wrestler. Wildfire did a Ric Flair impersonation. "I can't help it. I's born with a golden spoon in my mouth, honey. Ain't my fault I'm dressed in custom clothes. Got a Rolex on my wrist. Woo!" When the ladies paid no mind, Wildfire directed his attention towards a dude wearing a Kenny Chesney shirt. He loved issuing backhanded insults to strangers he perceived as beta males. "The shoes on my feet cost more than that boy made last month," Wildfire said, in the form of a wrestling promo. "Huh? Yeah, I'm talking to you, Chesney boy." "What the fuck?" "Son, I wouldn't go see Kenny Chesney if he were playing my backyard." Beta wasn't amused by Wildfire's antics, but he didn't flex with Emmy and me standing around. "Come on, man, let's go," I said, and chuckled. "Why do you do that shit?" On the way out, Wildfire snatched a tube from the server pacing around with shots, guzzled it, and tossed a 20 on the girl's tray. "Keep the change, darling." Another time, Wayne was outside smoking when we gathered him to head out. A middle-aged man sporting a clean dark beard strutted by. Wayne screamed, cigarette dangling. "Oh my God, it's Kenny Loggins!" Laughter erupted from onlookers as the Loggins look-alike blushed and passed by. Old Wayne sang, "I'm all right, nobody worry about me." I decided to lay low one night, because Wildfire's honky-tonk pace was hard to keep up. Despite feeling fresh the next morning, I was unnerved by an eerie call. "Hey man, you ain't gonna believe this," Wildfire said. "What's up?" "You know Kenny and Lauren, who hang here?"
"Yep."
"Kenny fucking killed her."
"What?"
I asked, while my heart sank. "Then he killed himself." "You gotta be shitting me." Wildfire got wind of this before it was reported in the media. His voice quivered while he spoke. He was shaken because he was possibly the last person to see Lauren and Kenny alive. Wildfire wasn't involved with the murder, but I reminded him an investigator might knock on his door. "Don't panic, man," I said. "Just clean the fucking condo."
"Why would someone come here?"
"Gee, I don't know, Wildfire. There are several calls and texts linking you to both of them. I bet you're one of the last texts and calls on both phones."
"Yeah, you're right," he acknowledged. "Get your shit together."
Wildfire dialed his trusted amigo, Miguel, to come to his condo and earn some overtime cheddar. He'd been with Wildfire since the redneck business days, had keys to the home, and came and went as he pleased. The casa received a makeover. Investigators never showed. That evening, I was glued to the local news. Kenny and Lauren were the top story. Murder in Atlanta isn't always top story worthy. It's a day in the city. But the background and circumstances behind this murder-suicide catapulted it to top story status internationally.
A picture of Kenny wearing shiny Marine Corps dress blues was shown as the story was told. What the fuck? Kenny knew I was a former Marine, and
sample complete. Ready to continue?